Week of the book of Job, and we are looking at perilous questions and stumbling answers. This book, hopefully those of you that were here last week, you grabbed the reading plan and you started reading through the book of Job. I already had somebody email me a really great question about something that happens in the book. It's such an extraordinarily old book. And so it works in a different way, and it operates on a lot of different levels, and I've really been just enjoying taking the time to read through it and kind of look at things a little bit different. And this is the first time that I've read Job. I know this sounds really weird, but this is the first time I've read Job having taken Hebrew classes and having enough resources to be able to go back over Job. And I could read it in Hebrew before, but there was a whole lot of stuff about it that I didn't really understand. And so I'm functionally illiterate in seven languages, so it kind of went over my head. This time, going back and reading some of this stuff and seeing how the word plays are being used and the rhyme patterns, really cool. But I'm not going to bore you with all that stuff because that's really, really nerdy. Instead, I want to invite you this morning. We're going to be looking at the second part of the first chapter. I want to remind you before we get into that, I skipped over it because I was disoriented. I'll remind you about this after the service today. If anybody has any questions or thoughts or comments about the five-year mission plan, we did want to carve out a little bit of time to be able to talk about it. There are copies on the back table there, and after service, probably about 10-15 minutes after service ends, I'll head downstairs to the fellowship hall to chat with anybody that wants to talk about it. If all of your questions can be answered by already having it, or you're just cool with it or whatever, great, wonderful. I catch an earlier show of the Batman movie. We want to give you the opportunity to be able to have that time to talk about it and discuss it. All the other announcements are in the bulletin. All right, back to Job. So we're in the second part of chapter 1, and so I'm going to invite you to turn there. And if you're visiting with us, there are Bibles in the racks in front of you. A page number is in the bulletin. I think there's a page number 359, 360 in that area. This is we're in the first part of Job. Job has three big chunks, basically. The first part is this introductory stuff, the prologue. It happens in chapters 1 and chapter 2. And then there's this massive time of this discussion, the perilous questions and stumbling answers part of the book. And then at the tail end, there's a third part where God himself speaks from a whirlwind and kind of sets everything straight. This first section, and I talked about this last week, this first section is linguistically very different from the rest of the book. We think, and this is just a theory, and there's absolutely no way to prove any of this stuff that I'm about to say about we think. That's why I say we think. That the book of Job, the story of Job, is very, very ancient. Probably dates from the Middle Bronze Age. And it's probably composed about a historical figure who lived in what is today northwestern Saudi Arabia, or somewhere on the eastern side of the Jordan River, what today we would call the West Bank, the East Bank. The West Bank is the western side of the river. So the eastern bank of the Jordan River, they live somewhere in that area. There's plateaus and areas, and semi-nomadic people have lived in there for thousands of years. Seems like it's occurring there, but there are bits and pieces of Job that reflect that perhaps as the story was told, the story was not actually written down and codified until after Israel returned from their exile, around 500, 550 BC, okay? So the story itself is transmitted, it's this big old story, and then it seems to have been kind of written down about that period. And we're going to talk about a couple things that hint about that. But this is just a theory. We have no idea. It could have been written 4,000 years ago. It could have been written 2,500 years ago. What's a millennia? I mean, seriously. It's ancient. It's old. We know that. And it was treated as something that was ancient and old, very, very for a couple of centuries before Jesus, it was already being treated as this very ancient old thing. So we don't really know for sure when it was composed. We certainly don't know who wrote it. Believe it or not, I had a class in undergraduate school where a guy spent like two class periods talking about who wrote the book of Job. And he was really, really into it. And you know what? We don't know. There's nothing at the beginning of the book of Job that says, this was written by Bill, Job's younger brother. There's nothing like that. It's anonymous, so we don't know who wrote it. The style of it indicates that it exists in two worlds. It exists in this world of the Middle Bronze Age, probably about 2,000, 2,500 B.C., but then there are pieces of it that seem to indicate 500, 550. It's a very interesting book. The book opens describing Job and all of his prosperity, living in the land of Uz, you know, with the Emerald City and the Scarecrow, and then it describes his wealth, his tremendous wealth, and his personal habits. And we talked about how he seems to be a chieftain. His sons are pretty much in charge of the business of his life, and he has devoted himself to religious observance in the story. Now, it's important that you recognize, and I should throw this out there before we get this was intended to be performed publicly. The book of Job was meant to be performed publicly as an entire dramatic presentation. That's the way it's written. It is written in a series of dialogues between four main actors, and then a supporting cast, and then, of course, the voice of God, which appears out of a whirlwind. And that's one of the clues, by the way, because God is never depicted in ancient Israel. There's no images of him. So when he speaks in the book of Job, it's from a whirlwind. So there was some kind of ancient special effect that they created to give this sense of a whirlwind as God speaks. It's really kind of cool if you think of it that way. If you think of it as this is a stage presentation, that's what it was. There are several books in the Bible that are like that. This one, Song of Solomon, is the same way. It's written that way. It's written to be presented. Ruth, Esther, they're all written to be presented that way. Ruth is actually a giant song, which is very cool. It was meant to be, it was like, you know, Palestinian Rhapsody. I mean, that's what it was. It was supposed to be this big, big dramatic presentation of a song. That's what it was. And Job is very much like, Job is more like Macbeth. Hamlet kind of a situation. Lots of soliloquies and stuff. So anyway, we're going to pick up in Job in chapter 1 and verse 6. And one of the most bizarre moments in the Bible. All right. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. That's Yahweh. That's the covenant name of God. That's why it's capitalized. In your Bibles, it says Satan, or some Bibles might say the adversary and have it capitalized. This is Hasatan in Hebrew, the adversary. That's actually what it means. Also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" And Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." And then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." And so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. When I was a kid and I read this, this was a troubling passage to me. There's a lot about this that does not fit into our perceived, our presupposed notions of God and Satan and good and evil. So we're going to look at it a little bit. I'm not going to dwell on it because it's actually not the point of the passage. People spend a lot of time on this, and this passage is really not the point of this. We're going to get into the point of what it is, this whole Satan and Son of God, but I want to explain it to you in the ancient context so we understand it. So let's go ahead and have one more word of prayer before we go there. God in heaven, we are here on earth, and our understanding of who you are and what you do is infinitesimally small. we know so little. Help us to understand, to embrace the broad mystery of your presence and existence, to have our faith grow. We pray this through Jesus Christ. Amen. Okay, so here's the deal. If I'm a kid and I'm reading this, I got a lot of questions. Why on earth is Satan showing up at God's party? All right, this is the number one question that occurred to me as a kid. The first time I read the book of Job, I was probably 10 or 11 years old that I remember reading it, and I remember sitting in the back of my parents' Volkswagen Bug. We had a red Volkswagen Bug. It implied that every single time, if I was not on my toes, the second we walked out the front door, one of my sisters would punch me and yell Super Beetle and get 10 points in the game. How many of you remember playing that game, the punch bug game? But no punch back, no punch back infinity. He punched me. Blah, blah, blah. If you don't stop talking, I'm going to stop this car. We had a Volkswagen Super Beetle. It only had two seat belts in the back seat. If any of you that owned it know that, there were three of us. That meant that my little sister got to sit on the shelf above the engine. Happier days when car seats were just car seats. Kids didn't get special seats. We just rolled around back there like marbles. I remember reading this, sitting in the back of my dad's car and reading this passage and going, what is going on here? All right. What? First of all, who are these sons of God? Because isn't Jesus the Son of God? So I get that question. And then secondly, what is Satan doing showing up in heaven? And why is Jesus having a conversation, God having a conversation with him? And why on earth does God sick Satan on this poor guy job? I got questions here. It was years before I came to understand what was going on. And I want to very briefly share what is happening here. This passage is one of the reasons that I made my comment that there are parts of this book that seem to come from later. And that doesn't make it not inspired. It doesn't mean somebody looked at it and go, well, God didn't do a good enough job. I got to put this bit in and make it more sense. The books of the Old Testament often went through periods of development and compilation and anthologizing. This is how Hebrew literature works. And God inspired all of that. In the book of Zechariah, we have a description, Zechariah chapter 3, and I'm not going to get into it, but we have a description of the Satan, ha-Satan, the adversary. This term, the Satan, the adversary, ha-Satan, only occurs three places in the Bible. Job chapters 2 and 3, which were or 1, 2, 1 and 2, which we're dealing with right now. Not chapter 3. He's not in chapter 3. Zechariah chapter 3 and 1 Chronicles chapter 21. He occurs only in those three places. And we know for sure that Zechariah 3 and 1 Chronicles 21 date from after the exile. All right. So they date from this 550, 500, 600 to 500, 400 period. All right, Zechariah actually names specific people. Zerubbabel, the prophet Joshua. So we know that where Zechariah fits. And 1 Chronicles is a post-exile reiteration of the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. So we know where it fits. This person, the Satan, the adversary, doesn't appear anywhere else in the Bible. Just Job and those two places. So it seems that they came to an understanding of what this relationship, this adversarial relationship between God, Yahweh, and the adversary was sometime in that point. Now people go, well, they must have understood it from the beginning. There's nothing in the Bible that says everything's at the beginning of the Bible, everything else that will be in the Bible is here, right? There's understanding that comes from prophetic visions during the Hebrew scriptures, right? And people, whenever I bring this up, people are like, so you're saying that they didn't know about Satan until this? I'm not saying that's definite, but they didn't write about him this way. They didn't understand him using this term until that period. So what we have basically is a setup of the stumbling questions that's happening, and we have a setup in a heavenly place that's called the Council of the Sons of God. Now, what on earth is this Sons of God bit? In the Hebrew scriptures, there are indications that there are supernatural beings, we would class them broadly as angels, who from time to time, somehow, in some weird non-time way, God calls them together and gives them jobs to do. They are not other gods. They are not other, they are not deities to be worshipped. It's not the gods of the other nations gathering around Yahweh. There's all kinds of theories about this. They're simply some kind of supernatural beings, angels, cherubim, seraphim, all those names that get kicked around. They have specific jobs, and at times, somehow, God summons them, and they come together. And that's what's being depicted here. Now, be careful about making any absolute statements about that. That's why I keep using the words appears, it seems like. This is not something you build a whole doctrine on. You don't say, well, I read in Job and Pastor Eric said, therefore I have this rock solid. This is we think, okay? This is we think. And that's what's being depicted here. Some kind of assembly, and they're asking the presenters of Job, whoever this author is, he's asking you to imagine the scenario where all of these have gathered before Yahweh. He is seated on his throne. He is giving out their jobs, and the adversary comes. And when the adversary comes before Yahweh, Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament, he says to him, have you seen my servant Job? And what's curious is that the adversary says, yeah, I've seen him. And then he describes Job's condition. He says, well, you know, Job only fears you because you put a hedge around him. Now, I'm going to upset the apple cart a little bit here. When people pray for another person and they pray for their safety and they say, God, put a hedge around them, don't pray that. That is drawn from this verse. And this is not what we want. Because guess what Satan notices? The hedge. He's like, you, God protected you because you got a hedge around you. Now, what this means is, and understand what is meant here. What is a hedge? This is actually a really good translation of the word, the Hebrew word. What's a hedge? Those of you that grew up in farms, you know what a hedge is, right? You suburbanites, you don't know what it is. On a farm, what's a hedge? It's a barrier, right? Usually you take all the rocks out of the field, you dump them in a space, and you let all the trees and growth build up on that hedge so that the people on the other side know where your property starts and theirs stops. And so you don't have to see him doing what he's doing. You don't have to see what he doesn't have to see what you're doing. This is exactly what it's describing. It's describing a hedge. Now, it may be that what's being described here is that if they lived in Moab and Edom, this region, then there are actually mountains around them that protect them from enemies. So he may have this in mind. I don't know for sure. But Satan says, does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? Now, when we read that hedge, we think, oh, God has put a protection and a blessing on Job. That is not what Satan is saying. Satan is saying is Job is an ignorant moron who doesn't know how the real world works because you built a hedge around him. If he could see how the real world works, he would not worship you. He would not fear you. If you would take off the blinders and let him see the real reality of life, then he would abandon you in a heartbeat. But you've hidden the world from him. You've blinded him. You've built this barrier around him so he can't see how things really work. And so as a result, he has this false sense of security. Now, doesn't that sound like something we could apply to our modern world? How many times have atheists and agnostics who want to attack the faith of the church, and I got to be honest with you, some of their accusations are perfectly valid. There's an awful lot of ignorance that goes under the name of Christianity. But so often they say, well, you have a faith that makes you comfortable. It's a faith that your faith helps you explain the situation of the world in a comfortable way. But if you really saw the reality of the world, how can you have your faith? How can you have your faith when you look out in the world and see suffering and see death and destruction and inequality? How can you hold on to your fairy tale God, your spaghetti monster in outer space? How can you hold on to him when you see the reality of life? That's what Satan says. That's no new argument. The argument is God has kept things from you. He's hidden the reality of the world from you, and you've chosen that blindness, but you need to open your eyes. Look around you and see the real world. Now, I got to be honest with you, and you guys know this about me. Because of my particular spiritual journey, when I opened my eyes, I looked around in the world. I am an atheist who can't get past Jesus. Because here's the thing. When I looked at the world, you know what I saw? Sin, darkness, and evil, and ugliness. Yeah, there are good people in the world. There are good people who are not followers of Christ. There are tons of them. It is not that the entire world outside of our faith is some kind of evil and malicious. But the reality is the vast majority of human experience through history has been ugliness, darkness, and pain. And that tells me just the reality of looking at the world and seeing the brokenness of the world. When you explore worldviews, and I hate that Christianity has acquired some of these traits, and I don't use the word hate lightly. When we look at worldviews that would abandon, euthanize, practice eugenics, because certain people are undesirable. They don't belong in our society. You know, and we look at the ancient world and we go, oh, the ancient world, you know. In the ancient world, the Greeks and the Romans, they would abandon little girls because they wanted boys. They wanted to be strong. Aren't they horrible pagans and awful people? Do you realize that that occurs in droves in Africa and India and Asia right now? If you are born into a certain sects of Hinduism, not all of Hinduism, but in certain sects of Hinduism, if you are born deformed or deaf or mentally impaired, you are abandoned as a human being. Not put into an institution or taken care of. If you want to read some accounts of this, by the way, there's a book called The Book That Made Your World. I can recommend it to you. It's written by a man who came out of Hinduism into Christianity, telling his story as a missionary in India, where his entire ministry was going to Hindu homes with abandoned children like this and taking the children out of the homes so they could be given basic care, wallowing in their filth. The images are terrible, right? So, and when you realize that that exists in the world, it doesn't matter how many good people there are, there's something wrong with our world. There's something broken. And as a person who believes that Jesus' purpose was to bring healing and wholeness and renewal and regeneration, I have a passion and a desire to see people healed and mended, not just converted to a religion so they can walk around and tell how great they are, but actually changed so they change the world. I believe in the hope of Jesus Christ. I don't believe the gospel is just about you getting to go to heaven and play a lyre. I believe it's about us bringing the kingdom to earth. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So Satan's argument to Job, to God about Job is, Job only follows you because he hasn't seen the ugliness of the world. Job only follows you because he hasn't seen the ugliness of this world. If your people lived in the real world, they wouldn't be faithful either. It's Satan's argument. Now, we can't get bound up on what goes on here, but God says to Satan, and this was another troubling one, he goes, go ahead. The hedge is down. Bring it on. Chapter 1 and verse 13. Now there was a day When Job's sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing, the donkeys were feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down their servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them." And this is the chorus to this song of lament, "I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house." And at this point, Job is going, don't sing the chorus. "And behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Now, remember, this was meant to be presented on the stage, so you can imagine how this would have looked presented in a staging setup. As you have this moment with the council of the sons of God, and they're kind of in the background of the stage, and they're having their conversation, and then Satan departs from the presence of God, and then we have Job, and he's standing there, and then you hear the trooping of the Sabaeans, and then this one guy runs in, he says, "And I alone have escaped to tell you." And then you hear the crash of fire from heaven. That's a depiction of lightning, by the way. Fire from heaven is lightning. You hear the crash of lightning, this multimedia presentation. A guy runs on stage and says, "I alone have escaped to tell you." And then you hear the clumping of the Chaldeans taking camels. I can't even imagine what these special effects sounded like. And the poor special effects guy in the back with his coconuts. But they run a little Monty Python joke there. And he runs on the stage. He says, "I alone have escaped to tell you." And then a fourth one says, "I was there, and then this wind rushed across, and it knocked down the house, and I alone escaped to tell you." And then in the narrative, we have Job, and he tears his robe, and he shaves his head. So, you know, I mean, obviously it's not hard to have a wig for him to tear it off. And he gets down on the ground, and he says, sings this song, which I've never heard anyone put to music. "Naked I come from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Now, what's interesting, this word, "the Lord gave," the Hebrew word is natan. So where we get Nathan from. So our buddy Nathan is a gift. That's what his name means. The Lord gave, the Lord takes away. And then this next line, "in all this Job did not sin or charge God." That is again the word natan. The Lord gave, the Lord took away. And then we have the narrator kind of standing off the stage. He says, "in all these things Job did not sin, nor did he give to God the blame for all of this." This is an extraordinary moment. Dramatically, it would be amazing, because this is kind of the close of the first act, right? Because then we go back to the council of the sons of God in chapter 2. But we have this moment, right, where Job has everything he cares, everything that Satan believes God has given to him, taken away. Satan tells him the only reason that Job worships you is because you've given him everything. You've protected everything he has. So take it away. And so it is taken away. And at the moment, Job responds, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return." Now I think, and there's no archaeological evidence for this. This is purely what my dad used to call sanctified imagination. I believe that Job was presented at festivals, and it was something that people would have seen year after year. Song of Solomon is the same way. I think Song of Solomon was something. Song of Solomon is something Christians haven't, most Christians haven't even read once. But I actually believe it was done publicly. People saw it. It was a celebration of the season of weddings and marriage and stuff. I'll get it. But I believe Job was performed at festivals. And I think just like when you go to a concert of your favorite band and you sing along on the choruses of your favorite songs, you know, those powerful moments. I mean, when Mike Card comes and he does his concerts, right, he starts singing, and all the people that know Mike's music, they start singing along. My wife keeps telling me to shut up because nobody can hear Mike, you know, that kind of stuff. She's like, you're singing, you're not supposed to be singing. I'm like, well, he shouldn't be playing if he doesn't want me to sing with him, you know. But when we have a concert and you hear that song, or you're driving on the radio and that song you love, or perhaps that song you loathe but your children love and so it's stuck in your head, you start singing along with that chorus. I think that when this presentation started, I think people brought their families together. There was a big show. I think it was actually done around the tabernacle and the temple. What biblical evidence do I have that? None. Except it's here in the Bible, so it had some kind of significance to the ancient Hebrews. They recognized it as the Word of God. And they would do this presentation, and the kids would wait. I think, just like kids who know how a movie is going, they have their favorite scene of that movie. They can't wait. I mean, I'm going to go see the Lego Batman movie. I can't wait for that moment. Whoa, Batman lives in Bruce Wayne's basement. No, Bruce Wayne lives in Batman's attic. I can't wait for that moment. I am stoked to go see this movie. All right, because my daughter and I will be laughing like idiots because we love the Lego movies. But I think the kids, and they sat there and they watched. I think the children watching this presentation, they went, there went the Sabbateans. Yeah, you know, and then they sing along with it. And I alone have escaped. Oh, there goes the fire from heaven. I alone have escaped. And there goes the Chaldeans. I alone have escaped. And then how the children have died. I alone have escaped. And then when Job gets to this song, I think everybody goes, naked came I into this world. And naked I will return. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I think they sang that. I think the ancient Hebrews sang that line. And they all sang it. Now, thankfully, they knew how the story was going to end. But this was a lesson for the children to understand. It was a lesson for the adults to understand where Job's faith came from. Because think about being an ancient Hebrew. Being the people of God was not an easy job. Have you ever read Joshua and Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings? It seems like every weekend somebody's invading them. They are always being chased out of their cities. They are always taking up in fortresses. They are always having to ask themselves, okay, I mean, if I'm one of the priests of Israel, at one point I'm going, okay, guys, we've got to stop doing wrong things, okay? Stop, all right? Because it's constant. It's constantly happening to them. They're constantly in oppression. They're constantly being persecuted. I mean, they had David, and for a little while, they ruled the whole area, and isn't this great? And then it's just this constant decline. The whole time, they get one king, good king, then they get a terrible king, and God has to punish them again. They do one good thing, then they get three bad things. There's constantly all this stuff going on. So if you're a people of Israel and you're teaching your children, you don't want to teach your children, if you just come and you believe and you have your faith, then everything will be happy. Nothing bad will ever go wrong. As long as you follow the instructions, it will be fantastic. You want your children to know, you know what? Being the people of God sometimes stinks. Sometimes we are left with nothing. Sometimes we think that we are doing really good and then the Chaldeans come and take our camels. Sometimes we think everything is moving along. We have to be aware that being the people of God does not mean that somehow we get a free pass on the pains of the world. You need to know that sometimes this is our song. Naked I came into the world. Naked I will return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Those of you who have lost a loved one, you know what it's like to sing that song. Those of you that lost children, my sister, her first pregnancy, my oldest sister, her first pregnancy, she's the oldest of our family. She called us to tell us she was pregnant. We were all excited, and then she miscarried that baby. My sister knows what it's like to sing that song. Of course, then she had her first son, Joshua. She had him by cesarean section. Everybody told her, that's it. You can't have any more kids. It'll be terrible. Five more kids later. And at 40, however old she is, I can't say, my sister, I think, given the opportunity, if my brother-in-law had said, okay, that's it. My insurance can handle only so much. I need only so many tax exemptions. She'd have more kids. She loves kids. My sister loves babies. She is crazy. Mom, don't tell her that. My mom's watching online. Do not say that to Kate. But this kind of situation, those of you that have gone through that kind of, those of you who have been on the brink of bankruptcy, lost everything, had nothing. There was no money in the bank account. There was no retirement funds left that you could draw on. There was nobody more that you could borrow from. You were at the absolute end. You know what it's like to sing the song. Naked I came into the world. Naked I shall return. The Lord gives. The Lord takes away. Blessed be the Lord. So what does all this mean? And there's a whole lot that this ties into in the whole book, but I want to kind of bring some kind of practical conclusion to this. Satan deluded himself into believing that Job's baseline of faith was the prosperity that God had given to him. Now, there is nothing wrong with Christians being prosperous. And there's not even anything wrong for Christians praying to prosper. For some of us, you know, some of us, whoa. I alone have escaped. Wow, a little special effects there. There is nothing wrong with Christians prospering. There is nothing wrong with capitalism. Some people think Christianity somehow is supposed to be this socialist utopia. The Bible never says anything like that. There's nothing wrong with Christians being wealthy. The scriptures are, in fact, without, here's a funny thing, without the beneficence of wealthy women, Jesus' ministry would have never gotten off the ground. You can read in the Gospels, there are actually women that financed his ministry, his traveling, his itinerant ministry. That's an extraordinary idea. One of them, by the way, was probably Peter's mother-in-law, since Jesus had, you know, saved her from dying. She was probably a pretty happy lady. And talk about Peter. And this is a side tangent, but can it get any better with the relationship with your mother-in-law that you brought the Messiah to the house to heal her? I'm like, Peter's, I got a free pass the rest of my life. My mother-in-law is never going to complain about anything. Anyway, back to Job. The reality is there's nothing wrong with us praying for prosperity. There's nothing wrong with us enjoying the blessings that God pours out upon us. I mean, there's nothing wrong. I mean, you know, Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof, my all-time favorite musical, and I only like two of them. So, but he says, God, I know we're your chosen people, but every once in a while, couldn't you have chosen someone else? I mean, we sometimes prosperity for us is just being able to make it to the end of the month without getting to the end of the money. I mean, sometimes prosperity is this over and above. But Satan makes this mistake of believing that Job's baseline for his faith is God prospering him. That's Satan's mistake. Satan makes a mistake. That's the point of this passage, by the way. The point of this passage is not to give you a theology about Satan. It is the comforting notion that Satan doesn't know everything about you, but God does. Satan makes a mistake about Job, and believes that Job's baseline of faith is that God had prospered him and blessed him, and that if God were to stop doing that, Job would abandon his faith. And Job proves Satan wrong. In fact, in chapter 2, there's this moment where Satan goes back before God. God goes, so how'd it go? All right? Because he knew. He knew what was going to happen. The baseline of Job's faith was that song. Naked I came into the world. Naked I shall return. The Lord gives. The Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Job, by the way, is the only person in this whole book who uses God's covenant name. He's the only person in the book who worships this God. Everybody else refers to him as Elohim or the Almighty, El Shaddai. They never refer to to God as Yahweh. Job is the only one who does that. Job and the narrator. There's a lesson there. But Job says it doesn't matter. Because my faith isn't based on God's prospering me. Naked came I into the world, naked I shall return. Right? The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That's his creed. That's his moment. And if there's anything to draw from this, it is this, that the baseline of our faith should not be our prosperity, but our poverty. All prosperity that God provides us, all the blessings that he manifests in our lives, they are not necessary. God is not required to prosper us. God is not required to give us anything. We are not entitled to receive a single thing from God except for judgment. It is his chesed, his steadfast love, his loving kindness. It is the very nature of our God that although he is not required to bless us and show us kindness, it at the very core of his being is the longing and desire to care for his people. But we cannot say that he will guarantee that to us. Our faith is not grounded on our prosperity. Our faith's baseline is on our poverty. That's what allowed Job to endure. When later on in the New Testament you read a line that says, the patience of Job. Remember that Job's patience to endure his suffering was not because Job was a strong, wonderful guy who had memorized his Bible and learned all the key verses. And therefore, Job's baseline of his faith was, I started this thing with nothing. I'll end this thing with nothing. So if the Lord gives, that's his thing. And if the Lord takes away, that's his thing. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He simply is. God is. That name, Yahweh, it means the one who is. He is who he is, and that's all that I can expect him to be. I have no right to require of God that he give me anything or that he maintain everything. You say, well, if God gives it to you, he'll never take it away. Oh, I wish that were true. Oh, I wish that were true. My grandfather retired from BOC Gases. My grandfather worked every day of his life from the time he was 16 years old. He and my grandmother eloped, and they got married, and they lost their first child, and then they had my aunt and my dad and my other aunt and my uncle, and they're going to hate that I called them aunts. I've lived in New England too long. My aunts. He worked every day of his adult life. He had a stroke in the early 80s, and his first question upon becoming conscious was, when can I go back to work? He wanted to provide for his family. He wanted to take care of them. My grandmother, both of them are in heaven now, so my grandmother was the world's greatest spender. I mean, she was extraordinary. When she passed away, there were about 12 boxes of Cheerios in the cupboard because she stocked up. She always bought the absolute best of everything. That was how my grandmother was. She figured there was no reason. My grandfather, by the way, when he died, had a pair of shoes he bought in 1963 because they were the best he could get, and he took care of them. And he used to look at me and he'd go, you know, if you took better care of those shoes, you wouldn't have to buy new shoes every year. I'm like, Pap, you don't understand. They don't make shoes like that anymore. Oh, I bet they do. I mean, that was my grandfather. My grandfather retired. He retired well north. He had well north of $1 million in the bank. He owned his house outright. He had the opportunity, and I still grieve over this. He had the opportunity to buy a condominium on the beach of the Big Island of Hawaii. He worked in Hawaii for 3 years, I think it was. What a terrible assignment that was, I'm sure. To work there, build a factory there. He had the opportunity to buy this property. Had he bought it, it tripled in value in 3 years, I think it was. He didn't buy it. He always regretted that. He retired. He had all of this money in the bank. It was fantastic. My grandfather only had a 10th grade education. He was an engineer, but he was a trusting person. He trusted a money manager. The money manager was paying my grandparents their retirement out of the principal of the money, and taking, he took and stole hundreds of thousands of dollars from my grandfather. When my grandmother passed and my grandfather sold his house and moved to Oregon, he sold the house and divided the money amongst his kids. And then he came to my dad and asked him if he could borrow the money back so he could buy a house because he had nothing left. You know what my grandfather used to always tell me? Lord gives, Lord takes away. When my grandmother died of cancer, the Lord gives, Lord takes away. You know, when I was there, my grandfather was passing on to eternity. You know what I thought? The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. See, our baseline of faith isn't that if God gives me something, he will maintain it and he'll keep it. Our baseline is not, if God prospers me, won't it be great? Our baseline of faith begins, the foundation of our faith has to start at that absolute bare bones declaration. Naked I came into this world, naked I will return. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And if your faith is grounded on that, if you can take your everything that you have all the way down to zero and ground your faith there, then it doesn't matter what trials and temptations and struggles you might face. It doesn't matter how dark the valley of the shadow of death is. You will fear no evil, for the Lord is with you. We were going to close with a song, but we're over time, so I'm just going to close with a word of prayer. And I'm going to pray for us. Creator of all things, I confess before you that I like the things I get and the things I have. I become attached to the vapors and mists of our human experience. And you know this about me, God. I can only speak about myself. But Lord, I repent of the sin of this focus. But more importantly, Lord, I ask that down deep underneath all of who I am, at the Job level, Father, I ask that I would have his faith. That even these things I am attached to, if they were to disappear, and even the ones I love, if they were to break my heart or they were to be gone, and even if my body were destroyed, and even if I find myself in the ash pits of suffering and despair, that no matter how dark it is, Father, that I would have the faith of Job. That my baseline would be grounded there and not up here. Father, you alone can transform who I am at that level. You know that level of me better than I know it myself, no matter how introspective I am. Lord, help our faith to grow deep, no matter what it looks like out front. And help us to be transformed by a baseline faith. For our focus to be not on all that we receive, but all who you are, that we might pray, blessed be the name.